And, you know, it's just such a, it's really neat for me to get to hang out when we're, I've gone to a lot of the big events that we've had on Zoom and grateful for them, but it's nice to be invited to a home group and to be a part of what a home group is doing. So thank you for that. And I'll do what you invited me to do a little bit and talk about sponsorship, but not from any particular place of expertise, certainly. I will tell you both in being a sponsor and being sponsored, both of those are probably areas where I am most regularly challenge myself to wonder how I'm doing. Wonder if I'm, as a sponsor, am I giving as good as I've gotten? Am I being effective? Am I being useful? Am I being available? Being available has been one of the places that I challenge myself, to be honest with you. So I'm just going to talk from experience. And, you know, asking somebody what a sponsor is or is like asking somebody what a husband is or a wife is or a real estate agent is. Or you can have the title, but it looks significantly different on different people. And that doesn't mean that it's being done more rightly or wrongly by one person to the next. But when I boil it down and try to figure out, you know, what is my role as a sponsor, it starts for me just like it did in working with others in our book when it says our only aim is to be helpful. So I'll start by trying to figure out how can I be helpful. What does that look like, you know, and that might change person to person. I will tell you, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my sobriety date is June 30th, 1989. And I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous through the legal system and having been convicted of my sixth DUI and a plea bargain agreement that ultimately had me go to treatment that cut some of the jail time off that they'd given me. And so I wasn't going, I didn't show up at Alcoholics Anonymous surrendered. I was captured. And I didn't, I hadn't made a determination in those first AA meetings that I was going to while in treatment and people brought meetings in. I had not decided that I needed or wanted to stop drinking early on. But by the time I got out of there, I won't tell my story, but by the time I got out of that treatment experience and had spent a little time with you, I decided I wanted to try to not drink. And Alcoholics Anonymous was how I was going to try to not drink. That's how I was going to go about it. But I didn't really know what Alcoholics Anonymous, what the program of AA was. I'd been exposed to it. I'd seen the 12 steps. We had talked about those things. I had a good treatment experience. But I'm just finding my way in August of 1989, wandering into my first meetings on my own and on purpose. And I went into a little place here in Nashville called 202 The Friendship House. It's been around for over 50 years as our clubhouse. And I walked upstairs and went into a small meeting. There were three meetings going on. And I wandered into a small little meeting that only had room for 12 or 13 people. And one of them happened to be a great big man, 6'5", 280, 300 pounds, named Frank D. And Frank was clearly running that meeting. He had not been elected or appointed. He had just, he was self-appointed, but he was running that meeting. And, but man, I was just, he was a big personality. And after about 3 weeks, I went up to Frank at the end of the meeting one day and I asked him if he would sponsor. And he said, let's go back here and talk about it. And we went back to another little room and he said, this is how he invited me into sponsorship. He said, I'll sponsor you, but I ain't going to give you rides anywhere. I ain't going to loan you any money. I ain't going to be a marriage counselor. I'm not going to be a career counselor. And he told me about eight other things he wasn't going to do. And I said, well, boy, I couldn't be more excited about this relationship, man. Thank you, Frank. And we left the room and for the next month, I went to that meeting 4 days a week that it met, but I never talked to him again during that time. I mean, he never called me. He never reached out to me. And after about a month, I went up to him after the meeting one day and I said, Frank, man, I said, you hadn't called or anything. And he said, this was so long ago, he was still calling me kid because he was about my age now at the time. And he said, hey, kid, he said, did I give you my number? And I said, yeah. He said, I go back in that room about 15 times a week with somebody and give them that number. He said, you want to talk to me? Give me a call. And so I started calling him. Now, I will tell you, do I think that's the right way to go about that? That's not the way I do it. But I will tell you, I'm sitting here 31 years later sober. So obviously, here's what's important. Frank was being Frank. I need to be Steve. And I think any of us need to be whoever we are. That we bring ourselves to that sponsorship relationship. But I've had three sponsors in my 31 years sober. I had Frank. I moved to Richmond, Virginia a year after that and had a guy named Joe Sullivan. And then I moved back to Nashville 8 years after that and had Frank again. And then when he died in 2008, I went over a year without really being sponsored. I appointed a guy, but I didn't use him. That was not a great approach for me. And after that, I went to the guy that's my sponsor now, a guy named Don Major out of Louisville. And I pulled Don aside at a conference because I'd been keeping a secret for about a year and a half in AA. And it was imperative for me to keep the secret because if the secret got out, I might not be president of the local chapter in AA as I had appointed myself. So I was holding an AA secret, and that's an uncomfortable secret to have. And I pulled Don aside one day and I said, Don, I'm going to tell you this secret. And since I'm going to tell you, I'm going to make you my sponsor and hold you to that confidentiality clause. And he's been my sponsor since then. But all three of those sponsors have brought different things to me. The single thing that they have brought that goes across the board is a love for Alcoholics Anonymous and a commitment to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and an understanding of what that is and a commitment to offering to help me at whatever level I'm willing to be helped in the process of continuing to first stay sober and continue now to grow in my recovery. At about 9 months sober, I had the first guy to ask me to sponsor him. And I called Frank I still was hadn't done my fifth step with Frank, and he had been pushing me. I'm obviously at 9 months. That's way too long to go. But I said, Frank, should I sponsor this guy? And he said, absolutely. He said, but don't let him pass you in the steps. He said, you absolutely sponsor him, but only do with him what you have done. And what he knew that was going to do, that my own pride and ego would have me move forward. So this guy didn't pass me. And I did. He said, I don't think you can get him drunk. And I don't think he can get you drunk. And I don't think you can get him sober. So give it a shot. But one of the things that I spent a lot of time, maybe at 2 or 3 years sober, I got some of my friends from Richmond, Virginia that's where, on here. And that's where I was during that time. And man, I gave a lot of thought to what my sponsorship style was going to be, right? Because you would hear people talk about your sponsor in meetings. And I wanted to wonder, you know, am I going to be the thoughtful, encouraging, pat on the back sponsor? Or am I going to be the tough, straightforward, hard ass sponsor? Am I going to be the call me every day sponsor or the call me when you got a problem sponsor? You know, am I going to give a firm, specific direction? Am I going to be assignment driven? You know, I'm given all this thought. And I tried all versions of that, by the way, at one time or another. I've done a little bit of all of that, but none of those are a style. At this point, I might look or sound like any of those versions of me with someone I sponsor if that feels like, and hopefully through prayer and inviting God into the process, if that looks and sounds like that's what's going to be most useful and helpful to this person. I don't have a one size fits all approach to how I sponsor somebody, because I think that my relationships with people are different, and sometimes people's life circumstances are different. And the program doesn't change for any of those things, but our engagement around how to best access that program and ultimately find a real reliance on a higher power rather than a reliance upon me or any human resource is what's critical. I have changed over the years. I will tell you one of the things, and again, I don't suggest to anybody how they need to sponsor. That's where I started, and I hope where I end. But I sponsor quite a few people. I don't know what that number is to other people, but my friend Bob one time at a conference was asked in a Q&A, how many people do you sponsor? And he said, it's none of your damn business. And the reason he said it, he was kidding, but the reason he said that is because if I put a number on it, you're going to attach some importance to that number, and it's not the number. And that number is going to be different for different people. But I will tell you, because the number feels like close to the max that works for me, is that I don't spend much time trying to talk people into anything. We have a conversation up front that I say I say for me, this, you're volunteering for this. You know, I'm not drafting you into the Army. You're volunteering. I want to help in any way I can, but I'm not going to. I said we're going to be having a conversation, and I'm probably going to make a suggestion or have an idea or a thought that I will pass on. And it's going to come out of that conversation. And I said, don't have your feelings hurt, but Tuesday, I probably won't remember the suggestion or who I gave it to. I'm not keeping a file on you. I'm not a caseworker. I'm not a case manager. I'm another alcoholic tripping down the road that's just trying to help where I can. And see, I hope I'm not taking the easy way out there, but I went through a period of time where I treated my sponsees like misbehaving teenagers, where I wanted my little posse, and I wanted to create a bunch of little mini-me's in AA. And trust me, AA doesn't need more me's, I promise you. And that's not my goal anymore. So I try not to become egoically invested in my sponsees anymore. What I want is to help somebody find and let them find and be who they are in Alcoholics Anonymous and not replicate this. But there are things that are important to me. Sometimes people will ask, have you ever fired a sponsee? Well, you know, that's not language that I typically use. But I have had conversations with somebody where I've said, you know, we seem to see a few of these things, critical things, so differently that I might not be a good fit for you. That doesn't make you wrong and me right. It just means our sensibilities are so different in a couple of critical areas that I might not be the right voice for you to hear. And I try to do that because I mean it, to do it in a way that is free. I've also told guys regularly because I've had this, I know some of you have been on both sides of this, where maybe you need to change sponsors, but you're afraid to. You're afraid to hurt their feelings, or you're afraid of what they're going to say. And I tell guys early on, I say, look, life is hard enough. Don't ever hesitate for a moment to come tell me if you think you need to go in another direction or I'm not being useful to you. I'm not a guy, and I talk, but one of the things I think is important is, like any relationship, you know, if you're going to go into business with somebody, if you're going to have a business partner, you would sit down and talk about your goals and aspirations and your values and your mission to see if those things sync up a little bit, to see if this is going to be a good fit. Again, it doesn't make one of you wrong and one of you right, but it might help determine compatibility. And it also clarifies the journey we're about to embark on together. So I'll sit down and try to have some of that conversation and say what this is going to look like. And now the way my life is constructed, pre-COVID at least, And given the number of men that I sponsor, I'm not a guy that's going to be able to sit down face to face with somebody a couple of times a week. And I tell them, I said, and if you need that, you deserve that. And there's plenty of people who can and will do that. And that might be perfect for you. Here's what it's going to look like with me. Let's talk about that. And we'll get this thing a run and see if it fits and see if we get traction together. So that's been a critical aspect for me. Obviously, first and foremost is for me with a new man, certainly, is to introduce him to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, to the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to go through those steps. And those steps are what is to introduce that man to or woman. I do sponsor a woman. Some people like that. Some people don't. I'm not telling anybody else. It would be disingenuous if I didn't make that. I do that after conversation with my wife, and it's a woman I've known for a long time, and I'm very comfortable in that relationship. But I encourage anyone to be thoughtful and prayerful in that choice. But you know, I want to, one of the things that was so useful to me by my sponsors, particularly early on, both Frank and then when I moved to Richmond, Joe Sullivan, was not just their introduction of me into the literature and then ultimately into the third legacy of Alcoholics Anonymous, taking the title of this group in Richmond, Virginia. My sponsor there sponsored me into the third legacy and into service. And I'm grateful for that. But both of those men also integrated me into Alcoholics Anonymous. They took me around. They introduced me to people. They made it easy for me to get connected. And, you know, that wasn't and isn't an unimportant thing for me. So I was very grateful that they provided that resource for me. I want to tell you that today at 31 years sober, I'm still sponsored. I called my sponsor this morning and to talk to him about going through a rough patch last week. And we laughed at me because, as I typically do, I'm telling him about a rough patch last week. He says, well, you know, you could have called last week. Don't just call and tell me you made it through. He said, I'm willing to go through that with you. But you know, pride and ego will stop me even at 31 years from picking up the phone and making that call. So I encourage you, if you're on here at whatever period of your sobriety, 30 days or 30 years, let's both pick up the phone. Let's reach out and take advantage of the people that are there to help us, because as our book says, that you and a new man must walk side by side. You know, and it tells me in that if we do, so this is not a vertical relationship. It's a horizontal relationship where one person has a little bit more experience than the other. And our book makes clear, I think, what my role is in sponsorship, among other things. It says, if you're an alcoholic that wants to get over it, we will tell you what we have done. If I'm sponsoring you, I tell guys sometimes, I said, I'm about to give you a suggestion, and it's something I have not done myself. And I make it clear, still might be a damn good suggestion. I said, why don't you go do it? Come back, tell me how it works. Hell, I might try this. But in truth, it's that opportunity. I want to be honest. The last thing I'll say in the minute that I've got to close in my 20 is that there is no more sacred relationship for me than a sponsorship relationship. The confidentiality that goes with that, what I hope is a respect for the other person and what he or she is going through, a willingness to say, I don't know when I don't know, a willingness to say, let's try to figure this out together, and a place that is safe to come, not a place that someone's afraid to come. And I know that you guys are going to hear a lot more meaty and useful information from my friends, Harold and
April 7th, 1987. My home group is in St. Louis. It's called AA on the Rocks, meets on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. I do have a sponsor. You just heard from him, Steve. Steve and I have been walking this journey for a little while, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. But I'm glad to be here. I live in Hillsboro, Missouri. It's about 30 minutes outside of St. Louis. I just moved back here from the Branson area back at the end of June. So I'm settled in now, and it's good to be back in my hometown where I got sober at. So I'm grateful to be here. It, you know, sponsorship is, like Steve said, it's you can get a lot of takes on it from a lot of different people. And there's definitely some, you know, some different approaches to sponsorship. I've been blessed. I've come from a long line of great sponsorship since I've been here, and it's made a big difference in how my life's turned out. And so I can't speak about it enough. But what I will tell you is, you know, I was introduced to AA in 1979 in a correctional facility, and I didn't get sober until 1987, again, in a correctional facility, when I finally asked God to come into my life. And from that day till now, I've never had another drink. But when I went to treatment, I didn't go to treatment in 1987 to go to AA, I can promise you. I had a desire not to drink, but not a desire to go to recovery. I went there because I needed a piece of paper for the judge, and that's all I really cared about, because I had a fourth and fifth DWI conviction, felony DWIs with a parole violation. So I was on my way back to the penitentiary. I was 21 going on 22. And so I was in a tough situation. And so the only thing that dominated every waking moment of my life was that trial that I was about to face. So I went to treatment. Thank God I got 12-step by a guy, who only had 2.5 months of sobriety. His name was Gary. And, he got out of that treatment center. So he was just back trying to carry the message and take people to outside meetings. And I was one of his guys that he 12-stepped. And thank God for him, because he was very persistent, you know, and in that effort to reach out to me and try to carry the message. And Bill Wilson has got a term for that. The terminology is magnificent reality, which you can find that on page 109 of the 12 and 12. But, you know, even refers to the newest of newest have this ability to share experience, strength, and hope to carry the message. And so his ability to reach out to me and win my confidence in a few hours, like there is a solution would say, worked. And he got me to go to some outside meetings. But when I came back to St. Louis, I had no plans to go to AA. I mean, I just really didn't, for a variety of reasons. And, you know, he would call me and say, Harold, you know, you really need to go to AA. Your life depends on it. And I knew that was a true statement, but I was really stuck between, I was on the jumping off point. I couldn't picture my life without alcohol, and I couldn't picture it with it. And so I just couldn't picture my life walking away from the life, the only life that I ever knew, which was really in the dark, but I knew it. So it was a real process. And he stayed on me for probably a good 60 days before I finally got the courage to go to my first AA meeting. And then I got a bus pass and went to the meeting, and I went to the physical location of the meeting. It was a 2 o'clock on a Saturday meeting, and I sit out on the bench in front of the hospital where the meeting was at, and I didn't have the courage to go in. And I ended up getting back on the bus pass and on the bus and went back home. But he called me again, and for whatever reason, I was transparent with him. I said, no, I didn't go. I couldn't go in. And he said, why? I said, I don't know why I didn't go in. I just couldn't go in. He says, you really need to go. And so eventually I went. I went to my first AA meeting and I started my journey to AA. I didn't want a sponsor. I had a probation or parole officer since I was 11 years old. So the last thing I wanted was another somebody telling me what to do, when to go, when to come. I just wasn't interested in it. So I came to AA like I did everything else in my life. I'm going to do it how I want, when I want, the way I want. Man, if you don't like it, it's too bad, because that's how I'm doing it. And you can run that road for so long. I ran it for about 3 years, and I was in love with AA. I loved the fellowship. I mean, I loved it. I was a sober drummer. I've been a drummer most of my life. So I was a sober drummer. I had a really great sober band called Alliance, and we were playing all kinds of gigs. I was a sober softball player. I mean, I was doing the deal as far as that goes, but I was on step none for pretty much. And you can only ride that ship for so long. And I finally, what I would call, come to the end of myself. About 3 years of doing that deal. And I finally broke down and did what was taught to me in 1979 in my very first AA meeting. I heard the same message, which get a sponsor, work the steps, you know, read the book, be a part of the thing, go to meetings, all the natural 101 stuff that we would give anybody coming into AA. And I was given that, you know, from day one. And but I just rejected it all. And so I finally come to the end of myself. I was just done. And I went and asked this guy who knew me all 3 years of my sobriety, knew me well, his name was Roy. And I went to his, I asked him, Roy, would you be willing to sponsor me? He says, why don't you just come over to my house? And so I went to his house and we met, and he goes, Harold, I've watched you for about 3 years now. Tell me about your life. Just tell me what's where you're at today. I said, Roy, I said, I'm 25 years old. I live in the basement of the house. I don't have any education. I don't even have a GED. I don't have a driver's license. I've never had a driver's license. I got a piece of crap car that's held together by a bumper stickers that I can't legally drive, but I do. My life sucks every which way you want to take it. Just take the word sucks, put it in all cap letters, highlight it, bold it, and flash it with Christmas lights. Sucks, sucks, sucks. That was where my life was at it 3 years, and I hadn't drank in 3 years. And so I just come to the end of myself. And so what he said to me changed my life. And it really, that was the moment that I walked into the a relationship and sponsorship. And what he said to me was, Harold, you know, I hear everything you're saying to me, my friend. And there's no doubt that you've been dealt a tough hand in life. I mean, I'm not pulling punches. There's no doubt you've been dealt a tough hand, but I hope you're going to hear what I'm going to tell you. And what he said was, every single thing, Harold, you have in your life right now, sitting at my kitchen table, every single thing you've got going on, you have because of the person that you become. And the day you're man enough to own that is the day you're on your way to some real change. But till you can own that, you're going to go on this little vicious cycle you're doing. And eventually you're going to drink again because you're not happy about your sobriety. Or you're going to do what my dad did. And unfortunately, my dad stuck a shotgun in his mouth and took his life. That's how my dad quit drinking. But to do this dance that you're doing, you can't do it any longer. So you're going to do one or two things. You're either going to grow or you're going to go. And the million-dollar question is, what do you want to do? And I definitely didn't want to go. And I knew he's going to say, let's work the steps. And I was just, as Lake Clancy would say, God rest his soul, you know, the hardest thing for any of us here to do as individual members is to take actions that we don't believe in. And I just didn't really believe the 12 steps would change my life because I had such a consumeristic, individualistic mindset for what happy, joyous, and free looked like. You know, and that was, call me crazy, but I think I could be a little bit more happier if I had a few hundred dollars in my pocket. Call me crazy. I mean, that made sense to me. Or, you know, I had a driver's license or a car that was legal or a better looking girl or a girl at all. Those were the things that were running in my worldview of what it took to be happy, joyous, and free. And I didn't have most of those things. So I struggled, but it took me a while. But I came to the end of myself. And I've sponsored a lot of guys in 33 years that I've been here. And I haven't met one of them that's fully did this deal until their life depend on it. And so that's what I know. And so I think that covenant question, that's what I would call sponsorship a covenant, but that covenant question of, are you willing to go any lengths to have victory over alcohol? That's the engagement question. That's what seals the deal. It's either a yes or it's a no. And if it's a yes, then we're going to start this journey. And that might look a little different for a lot of people. The very first pamphlet ever written on sponsorship was written by a guy named Clarence Schneider in 1944. And it's a great pamphlet. And this is what he writes. I just want to read a couple sentences here from the preface of what he wrote. But this is what he wrote. This is a preface of that pamphlet from 1944. He says, each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is a potential sponsor of a new member and should clearly recognize the obligations and duties of such a responsibility. But I think that's important. He goes on to say, the acceptance of an opportunity to take the AA plan to a sufferer of alcoholism entails very real and critically important responsibilities. Each member undertaking the sponsorship of a fellow alcoholic must remember that he is offering what is frequently the last chance of rehabilitation, sanity, or maybe life itself. Happiness, health, security, sanity, and life of the human beings are the things we hold in balance when we sponsor an alcoholic. And then the last paragraph I'll read is, no member among us is wise enough to develop a sponsorship program that can be successfully applied in every case. In the following pages, however, we have outlined and suggested procedures which supplemented by the member's own experience and have proven successful. And so I think that's a real, you know, clarification of how serious the covenant is to be someone's sponsor. You know, it's interesting, my sponsor, Tom I, who is my sponsor most of my sobriety, some of you know Tom, he's still alive today, he lives in North Carolina, he's 63 years sober. Unfortunately, he contracted Alzheimer's and he's, you know, suffered from that for about 6, maybe 7 years now and just wasn't available to be a, you know, sponsor anybody anymore. But he'll be my sponsor till it goes to the big meeting in the sky, no doubt. But one of the most precious moments I had is being in North Carolina with Tom at Clarence Snyder's grave. And about 10 of us, the guys he sponsored around that gravesite, as he told us the story of Clarence Snyder. And it was really, really powerful. It was powerful, really, how the story ended, because Clarence had some real challenges in his life, personality-wise. I never knew the guy, never had any experience with him, so I don't have no direct comment. But I know he had some challenges, and he pushed a lot of people away from him. And unfortunately, when he died, this is, comes from my sponsor, Tom, directly, but there was only about 30 people at his funeral in North Carolina. And Tom said, I was the only member of Alcoholics Anonymous that was there. And this is the guy who wrote the first pamphlet on sponsorship. So that's an interesting dynamic when you really sit and think about that. So anyway, all that said, I hung with Roy for a while. There were some challenges there. I don't want to get into it because that's Roy's business. But I moved on to another guy named Bill Piper, who's no longer with us. God rest his soul. And he got really, really ill. At that time, I was, doing a lot of correction stuff. I've been involved in Department of Corrections, doing AA and corrections for about 25 years. And so Tom, I did a lot of corrections conferences together, and we were together in Las Vegas and in a room, and I was in this gap, with sponsorship, and we had a great talk about it. And I said, is that something you think we could do together? And so he agreed to that, and we made a covenant, and the covenant was simply this, that, the main obligation between me and Tom was transparency, commitment to living a three legacy life, being a three legacy member, being a part of a three legacy group, having a weekly committed time that we were going to spend time together, which was that was 7:30 in the morning on Tuesdays for me for a lot of years. And he said, here's what the expectation was. So we went through what the expectation was. And then he went with this clarifier, and he goes, now, if I ever feel like these expectations aren't being met, mainly transparency, then you're giving me permission right now to go speak to your wife, your family, your AA community, or whoever else. And so I gave him that permission, and the covenant was set. And so it took me to a whole new level of commitment to what it looked like to be sponsored. Especially in a three legacy format. And it just made such a huge difference in how my life turned out. It really, really did. And so when Tom got ill, I knew I needed to make a change. And Steve was that guy for me. And I hadn't met Steve years before that, but Steve and I had a lot of parallels. We're both from the Midwest, east and or the upper South, if you want to call it. He's in Nashville, I'm in St. Louis. He's got a daughter, he's married, and he's committed to this thing, Alcoholics Anonymous, in a big way. And so and so we already had a relationship going. So it was an easy call for me, and it's worked out, and with a similar covenant that we have with each other. And we've had to change our dates a few times, but mine's 7:30 on Friday mornings. And for the most part, we keep that. Once in a while our schedules get boggled, but that's a pretty committed covenant that we have, and it's there. And so I spoke to him this morning, as part of that commitment. So it's a covenant to me. It's a big deal. I need somebody who's not emotionally involved in my life, because the problem still centers in the mind. I mean, it's an illness of delusion. I can't always see myself for what I really am. In my mind, I can sit and think I'm a great husband all day long, but if I really want to know if I'm a great husband, who should I ask? Well, start with your wife, or your inner circle. It'll give you a much better clarification than what I think. So My mind has always been my worst enemy. So I need somebody who's not emotionally involved in my life. I need somebody who's not financially involved in my life to help me make clear decisions. And I got somebody that I can trust and I know will be transparent with me. And Steve's always that. Steve's always been vulnerable about his own shortcomings and his own faults in his life. And so I admire that about him. And that works well for him and I. And he's not a little mini me guy, because if he was, I'd have a bald head right now and a goatee, and I don't have to have that. So I'm grateful for that. We might have a problem if we did all that. I just don't think I'd be very cute with bald head, especially all the scars I got on my head, believe me. But it's a great ride. And somebody asked me that, I heard Tom be asked that question as well, from a workshop that we were doing, how many guys do you sponsor? And Tom's answer was, however many I talked to that day, because it's a day at a time deal. And I've always loved that answer. It's like, I don't know. I spoke to two or three guys today. I guess that's how many guys I sponsored today. It's that kind of simplicity. So it's not about results. It's not about numbers. When I sponsor guys, it's simply the same covenant that I was given. Are you willing to go to a link to have victory over alcohol? And I, you know, I'm committed to walking through the steps, the traditions, and the concepts, and trying to help them become a full-rounded Three Legacy member. I think that's important. I ask them to be a part of the Three Legacy group. And I ask them to do the two things that really made a difference in my life. And I'll really wrap it up with this. You know, I was told early on by Roy, and couldn't have got better advice in my life. He said, Harold, there's two things you need to do for the rest of your life. And if you do these two things well, you'll live an unbelievable life. You'll probably have a storybook life. And these two things are this. Number one, you always got to have a new guy you're working with. And if you don't have a new guy, you stop what you're doing. You get out your rods, you get out your reels, you get out your bait, and you go fish where there's fish. And if you're in a metropolitan area, there's lots of great fishing holes. But you go fish out a new guy. And I've never had a shortage of new guys in my life. The second thing that he told me to do is that you need to go somewhere once a week where you don't want to end up. And for me, that started in Skid Row Mission down here in St. Louis on Washington Street. And I went there every Thursday night and every Friday morning for 3 years. I went, and or Saturday morning here for 3 years. Hardest day I ever did in my life. But it was the best day I ever did in life because it really shaped me to sponsor. It really shaped me to deal with the most broken of broken. Helped me deal with all the isms that I had inside of me, which is a lot. Helped me deal with a lot of the phobias I had inside of me, which were a lot, you know, because I had to deal with them. They were out in front of me. And so I was able to process and grow through a lot of that. And but then the call came in 1993 and said, would you come and speak at this prison? I started laughing. I said, man, do you know who you're talking to? And they said, yeah. And I said, man, they're not going to let me come out to that prison to talk. And he says, I think you've been off paper long enough to let you. And I said, well, I made a pact a long time ago. I ain't never going back behind no fence for you or anybody else. So you can, I'm not interested. And he said, well, why don't you run that by your sponsor and call me back? Well, you know how that went. Sponsor said, man, if they're letting you in, you're going. Actually, he went with me. And that started my journey in correction. So I've been in that ever since. Unfortunately, because of COVID, we've been shut down. And so I still try to live by that principle of going somewhere once a week where I don't want to end up. And so I was able to get, right before I even moved here, I got connected with a treatment center about 20 minutes from where I'm at and was able to do a program in there on Wednesdays that I just go in and lead. It's just me talking with a bunch of new people and talking what it's like to be sober and living sober. And then we do a Sunday night meeting there as well. So that's my commitment now where I don't want to end up. And so those are the basic things that I ask you guys, you know, as we grow. And obviously we're going to work through the steps and adopt a life and accountability and having a covenant. And, you know, I remember when I went to Tom's 50th anniversary in North Carolina, my buddy Roy's on here from North Carolina. He's one of Tom's guys too. And so we went to this and I got a picture. I don't know how many of us are in the room with Tom getting our picture taken, you know, in a group picture of the guys he sponsors. One of my most cherished moments. But I remember when we went up on stage, some of us went up on stage to share, and the very first guy said, my name's Larry, and I'm 8:45 on Tuesdays, you know, and that's how everybody introduced herself all the way down the line, was why they're calling Dane. I started laughing. I never forget that. That's one of my highlights of sponsorship. But it's a great life. And if you're on here, you don't have a sponsor, I mean, that's you're probably not going to stay here. This would be transparent with you. You really need to have somebody walking this journey with you. And through that, over the years, I have a, you know, whole inner circle of guys that I call my inner circle. I share a nightly review with my sponsor every night, have for years. And I do that with the little guys in my inner circle. And some of those guys are on here as well. And I ask them to do the same in return. And so, you know, I get dozens of those things every night and I read every one of them and it helps me stay connected in a big way. So I need this as much today as I ever did in my life, because spiritual pride can really come in and be a killer for people like me. So it's just good for me to stay really, really accountable and stay down to earth. So that's my 20 minutes. I'm glad to be here, be sober. Thanks for the invitation.
Sorry, I don't have a shirt and tie on, but I was just attending tonight. But I'm coming to you from Staten Island, New York, and it's an interesting topic, and I couldn't miss it. I was a couple of minutes late. I apologize for my friend Steve there, but I was up with the grandkids, and it just takes a priority here when they're living in the home. So for sponsorship with me, I'm sober since 1995. Grace of God and AA in my home group, and sponsorship. I fought sponsorship my first year. Didn't want to get it. Didn't want to stay with you folks. I was kind of looking for six steps to control drinking and not getting arrested. I didn't really want to stop. And I got a guy, a real fellowship sponsor at first, and Staten Island was a place of making a lot of meetings and doing some service, and that worked for me for a while. John, my first sponsor, was sober 7 years, and he was just a tortured soul, and he hung on as long as he could, but then he blew his brains out, and that's how I lost my first sponsor. And powerful lesson. Each man that's guided me here has given me some very powerful lessons. And then I had some events in my life that happened that really put me at a sober bottom at 18 months removed from alcohol and drugs. And, you know, I don't know if anybody else had this experience, but I came in thinking I had a drinking problem. And I didn't realize that spiritual malady and my mind was all over me. And I wasn't free enough to talk to anybody about that at the home group or anything. I just wasn't that involved in AA. And a man named George, a bald-headed bookie from Brooklyn, covered in tattoos, rough-speaking dude, attended a big book workshop on Staten Island and went through the 12 steps, and this boy was on fire. And he 12-stepped me on a golf course, and I had just lost a 17-year career due to the arrest that brought me in here. And we went through the journey together, George and I, twice a night. I heard Steve mention that he's not that guy. This guy was. He was retired. He had a laid-back lifestyle. He had the time to listen to me, to talk to me. But most importantly, he told me nothing that didn't come out of the first 164 pages of our big book. And, man, it was transformational. And I heard one, I think Harold might have said it, that, you know, that why are we going to do things that we don't yet believe in? Well, George just had a peace and a calm over him that I wanted. And that was the most attractive thing to me as a 37-year-old, 18 months dry, wanting to kill myself. This guy just didn't have a care in the world. Told me a story about how he got past his son being murdered. I mean, how do you do that? And he meant it. I mean, the boy was on fire. So what happened with George was George went a different path. He was moving down to Florida. He really stopped attending meetings and things like this pretty rapidly. I was in like the 11th step when we were going through. And but I stuck with George. We finished. And then a man, Joe, was put into my life through GSR and a service structure, and he became my service sponsor. And I went through the traditions with Joe. And I got so comfortable with Joe that I spent the next 23 years of my life with Joe. Joe passed away about a month ago. And a lot of my friends, a few that are in this room, had helped me with that. I don't know how to grieve. I don't know how to do that stuff. I had a sponsor to help me with that stuff, and now I don't have that. And what happens after that? You can't replace a sponsor. You can't replace Joe. So I did what AA and some of the older guys that have lost sponsors, long-term sponsors, told me to do. They said, pray. They said, make sure you say a good goodbye to Joe. Grieve him. I did that. I did a lot of crying the last few weeks. And I wrote some things down, and I wrote what I wanted in a sponsor. You know, and I wanted an active member. I want somebody that's going to push me, not tell me what a great job I'm doing because I have a home group commitment and I'm in the service structure. I want them to push me. I want them to hold me accountable. I need to live a transparent life because, you know, those corny old sayings that we hear, you're only as sick as your secrets. I've seen secrets take people out of here that were solid AAs just because they didn't have that one-on-one sponsorship thing going on, or they held things back. I need to lead that transparent life. And I see people from all over the country and even out of the country, but in this area, that really narrows the pool of who are you going to ask. It gets to be some slim pickings here. And, you know, so I wasn't afraid of a long distance commitment. I know a lot of men from a retreat, the usual suspects down in Tennessee that I frequent. And some other places. So the list was kind of easy to come up with. But I just want to tell you how God works in my life. I just said goodbye to my sponsor in a memorial mass virtually. I wrote a couple of paragraphs in a book thanking him, thanking God for letting me be in his life. And then I wrote about 67 things down in bullet point form that this man walked me through in 23 years. I was emotionally wiped out. I took a nap. I woke up. I started to pray, and I wrote that list for sponsorship. That night, I get a text from Harold Wong that says, "Hey, buddy, can you do a big book workshop? We're doing it. There is a solution next two Tuesday nights." And I said, "Sure." And I said, "Oh my God, he was on my list." I said, "I get it, big guy. I'll call him." You know, and then with 25 years sober, 61 years old, fear comes over me that Harold's going to say no, I'm not good enough to be sponsored, and all that bad thinking that comes up. The reason I need a sponsor, right? But I called Harold, and he was the most gracious on the phone and said, "Of course, brother, I'd be honored to walk this journey with you." And we talked about a committed time to call, although we haven't scheduled one. This just happened this week. But I've sent my inventory to him these first four nights or three nights. I write inventory as well. I'm prepared to do whatever he did. I registered for an institution commitment. And my wife's not happy about it, but I said, "Honey, I'm following directions. I gave this man spiritual consent to enter my life, and I'm not playing around." And it's not that I want to be able to say those things in meetings and feel like, "Hey, I'm doing it," and this and that. Folks, I need it. I don't do well when I'm holding things in. I don't do well when I'm not honest with somebody and when I have those secrets. Things just don't lay out in my life the way that they have otherwise. And I am always willing to sponsor men up here. I did do a short, maybe about 5 years span of sponsoring women. And I was from the school at that point. That the men from when, if you were spiritually fit, it didn't matter and all of this. But I can tell you, for this alcoholic, it did not work well. I felt that I treated the women differently than I do the guys. After we ended those relationships, a couple of the women told me, "There were some things I just couldn't tell you, Tom. But thank you for everything you did," and blah, blah, blah. In some instances, it seemed to work a little bit, but so for now, I just stay with the men, and there's enough sick guys out there to keep me supplied, I think, for the rest of my time here in AA, at least here in New York, there is. I love that fishing hole line that Harold uses, man. You know, if you want to get a sick fish, just go to the polluted pond and you'll get one. And that's where we go. I don't attend all those meetings where all the, you know, my home group is a three legacy group, but I don't attend all the groups where I'm going to hear everything I agree with. I go and I look for a newcomer, and my eyes are trained on that door. And that's what Joe taught me. And you know, we don't really exchange big gifts here, my wife and I, on Christmas, because we do a lot of things for the house or for the kids. And the only thing I asked for this year was a WWJD bracelet. And she's going to get me one of those. But for me, I mean, my Christian friends will say, "Wow, it's about time he came over," you know, but for me, it's going to mean, what would Joe do? That man invested so much time and love and let me enter his home. We spent holidays together. We did commitments together. I'm really glad that Harold and Steve, good friends of mine and men that I admire in this program, got the opportunity to meet Joe last year. Is it 2 years now again? I don't know. Pre-COVID, I'm kind of dated out here. But we got to experience that together. And when I was down there on Sunday, and I'll sum it up with this, God just moved me to stop as we were walking out of these moldy, sink dripping, horrible mattress rooms that we had down there. And I just put my hand on Joe's chest and I told Joe, "I would not be the man I am today, the AA member, the husband, or the father, if it wasn't for you, Joe. And I just want you to know that I love you for that." And we hugged, we cried a little bit. And to me, that's what sponsorship is. It's being open and honest enough with another man. And boy, when he would tell me the truth, it would sting. Oh, it would sting. He'd made my 11th step all the time. I would write about Joe. I never hung up on him, though. And I never threw the big tantrums. I threw them after I hung up. But I'm not looking for you to replace him, Harold. Believe me. I'm looking forward to a new journey with you. That's all I got. Sponsorship is key for me. I love you guys. Thanks.
Thanks, Tommy.
Thank you so much, Tommy. I feel like that was a God moment right there. Somebody didn't show up and you got called on the spot to share. And I really appreciated what you had to say. So, all right, here we go, guys. I've got some questions in the chat. Anybody who has any questions, please send them to me in the chat. I wish that I was able to unmute people to share, but unfortunately, I can't do that. So that way, you can just send them to me and I will relay them, and all three of our speakers can either respond with their each own perspective or how they would handle whatever the question may be, or if it's directed to one person, I'll direct it to that person. But the first question that I have, and I'm going to ask all three of you, okay, to be able to unmute. There you guys go. So that way all three of you can answer. Okay, the first question is, what are your feelings about sponsoring somebody who identifies as dually addicted? It's up to you guys who's answering first.
Steve, alcoholic. Well, you know, for the first year that I was sober, I introduced myself in meetings as an alcoholic and an addict. I did that. I think nobody told me not to. Nobody beat me up about it, and I would. It became unnecessary for me after a period of time. I don't have a problem sponsoring somebody who identifies as duly diagnosed or duly addicted. What I ask anybody, that I'm not worried about who's in my AA meeting. I'm worried. I want my meeting to be an AA meeting. And so when that person is there, I encourage them to be respectful to Alcoholics Anonymous, and so I don't, and that's also not a battle I'm going to have with somebody in the first conversation that we have. That's where I want to spend time with somebody and give them and understand their point of view, share mine, and like was done with me over a period of time. Some of the ANDAs they didn't become unimportant to who I am personally, but they became unnecessary as part of my participation in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm open to that and then see where that goes over time.
Thank you, Steve. Harold, would you like to?
Yeah, my name's Harold, I'm an alcoholic. You know, when Gary took me to my first meeting, he said, Harold, we're gonna go into this meeting tonight and it's a closed meeting, and if they would call on you, you just say your name's Harold and you're an alcoholic. Don't add anything to it. You know, I know that you're a hillbilly and you probably huffed this, snorted that, smoked this, did that, and you're a hillbilly. So you probably slept with a few farm animals too. So alcohol is, when you say you're alcoholic, it has a broad definition. We know what that means. But if they call on you, let's hope they don't. But if they would, let's just keep it Harold the alcoholic. So I've been Harold the alcoholic from day one. In 1979, when I first came to AA, the big buzzword was chemical dependent, you know, so that was a word that was, you know, monkey see, monkey do. You just parrot things that you hear other people do. You know, we talk about three purposes all the time: our singleness of purpose, our primary purpose, and our real purpose. And singleness of purpose is important, but in today's time, I mean, let's just be transparent. There's not a lot of true, just pure guzzlers that walk into AA like maybe they used to. You know, I was a get high freak. I'm sure I'd done birth control more than once. You know, if you had it, I would eat it. You know, I was that kind of guy, but I was a guzzler through and through. So most of that stuff, and I get a lot of it in the prison. I mean, that's really, really parroted language in the prison system. And so you have to, you know, teach guys, you know, the same way I was taught. You know, I'm probably not as sarcastic as Gary was with me, but I at least guide him down the road to what singleness of purpose means, identification means, and why that's imperative that we live into that. So, you know, our big book, Waste to Page 7, before it mentions drugs. I mean, you know, Bill had the sedatives and then the gin and all that good stuff going on. So, I mean, it's not like a antichrist statement. It's just, you know, people come here with what they got. And so they just need, that's where sponsorship comes into play, to sit down and sponsor them and help them understand traditions and language and etiquette and all the things that we have going on in AA. And I think if you do that, people respect that. I'm in a maximum security prison and they respect it very, very well. So why not anywhere else? So that's all I got. Thanks.
Tom, would you like to add on to that also?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I have absolutely no problem sponsoring somebody that claims they're dual addicted. I would, you know, tell them about singleness of purpose and make sure they're not doing it. But it's my job as a sponsor when we go through that book to find out his truth. And if he's not an alcoholic, then I'm going to do my best to steer him to the fellowship. And I have a lot of friends in different fellowships that can help him more than we can. And without that identification to do those things that we don't know or understand, he's setting himself up for failure with that. And you know, what do we hear? We hear, well, you know, the fellowship's stronger here. Well, it's stronger here because you haven't gone through the 12 steps and you're not where you belong. You know, if everybody got recovered and went to the fellowships that we did. And I went to a couple of fellowships in the beginning because I didn't know. But when I finished the first step with a sponsor, I knew. I'm an alcoholic drug abuser. I will put anything in my body after I have a few cup drinks. Everything's a good idea. So it's my job to sort that out with that person and politely and kindly and lovingly, you know, get them the help that they need. You know, you can't come in on your first step and have it be a lie. And you know, that you're off on a bad preface. So, but that's it. Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you so much. All right. Next question. Do you take your sponsees through the steps quickly so that they can pass it on, or do you take your time? Go ahead, guys.
I'm of the belief that sooner is better than later. At the same time, that is going to vary person to person and based on circumstances and the nature of that relationship. So it is a variable with me. But the intention is to try to, for me and for the other person, is to try to move judiciously and expeditiously through the process of the steps, but not rush it for time's sake, but do it as feels organic and natural and as circumstances allow.
Yeah, Harold Alcoholic. I you know, I'm right there with Steve. I mean, I don't think there's a boilerplate template. I think that's what the pamphlet tried to lift up that I read too. That there's just a boilerplate statement for anybody. But I mean, if you look back to the origins of AA, I mean, they didn't waste no time. I mean, you were writing inventory and making amends immediately. And that's the solution. You know, as our buddy from Tennessee would say, Mike would say that, you know, my life didn't get better as a result of these meetings. It got better as a result of these steps. I mean, obviously the meetings are part of it. So the quicker I engage somebody in what's going to change their life, the better. And my sponsor, Tom, had a great quote. It's one of his favorite quotes. And he would always say, you know, when preparation meets opportunity and God does the introduction, amazing things can happen in your life. Well, there's a lot of opportunities, friends, that passed me by when I was working step none, I can promise you, because I just wasn't spiritually mature enough to live into any of those things. But once I started the journey and the steps, it didn't happen in one big cataclysmic explosion, but it happened pretty quick. You know, my life started to work, and then the spiritual mathematics kicked in, and 2 + 2 didn't equal 4 anymore, and the impossible became possible. You know, on that page 64, you put the spiritual head and material, you straighten out physically, you straighten out mentally, you can add emotionally and spiritually, all those things on down the line started to happen in my life almost immediately. So I don't want to keep anybody from that any longer than I have to. And so if they're capable, man, we're going to get in and get busy pretty quick and do this deal.
Yeah, especially with a new guy that, you know, I have the I don't know if you want to say a reputation of a no-nonsense sponsor in my home group. So if there's a guy that's coming in and out and the young guys are talking to him, but he's struggling, they said, you should probably go ask Tom to help you with the steps. And when that young man comes to me and you know, nowadays these young kids, they don't relapse and then just, you know, crack up their car, they're dying. So there's a whole nother level of, you know, life and death put on top of this, at least in my area here. So I'll take you through pretty quick. My job is to get you enough power to stay sober. We can do a deeper dive later, and then we'll go through the traditions and the concepts as well. But as quick as we can to get you the power that you need to get you in amends, get you living in 10, 11, and 12. And then, hey, let's talk about the steps again, if you like, you know. So.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. The next question says, what does a sponsor do about a man with 30 years of sobriety who keeps repeating these same unsober behaviors? I keep telling him, can't tell him anything he doesn't know, which is true, but he doesn't seem to have the willingness to change anything.
So I have one for that real quick. If you're unwilling to take suggestions or change behaviors like that, I will not fire you or any of that stuff. You've just lost the opportunity to talk to me about it. So if it's with his wife and he just keeps going on with the wife, but he doesn't want to be a better husband, I'm just like, listen, you can't talk to me about the marriage stuff anymore. You've refused every suggestion. You refuse to do anything I've done. So I can't help you there. I'm just not a sounding board for your bad behavior. So.
Steve, Harold, you guys know anything there?
Well, I'm in tune with Tommy there that I'm willing to have a conversation a couple of times, and I don't pretend to have the answers, but like I tell somebody, if you think I'm wrong 80% of the time, why would you want me as a sponsor? I mean, I might be wrong, but you should. But it's also just what Tommy said, that if I have offered whatever suggestion or feedback I have and the individual has chosen not to execute that and pay attention to that, I don't have a better plan. So you don't come back. I said, I gave you the best I got. And so there's no reason to talk about this same problem because I just have the same suggestion. And I do exactly like Tommy. That's particularly true in relationship stuff. I'd say that, look, if you haven't done this, then why should we keep talking about the problem? You just want to relitigate the case. You don't want to get mediation. You want litigation. So.
Well, you know, I'll give you the greatest example I can give you, and that's what Roy did to me. You know, early when I asked Roy to sponsor me, he agreed to that covenant, and we started that journey. I lived real close to Roy, so that made it convenient I could walk because I didn't have a license, and I had a car that I'd only drive to work in maybe a few meetings, but other than that, I just couldn't legally drive it. But I'd walk to his house, and I'd go there in the afternoon. I'd work construction. He worked construction. I'd go to work really early and get off early. And so early afternoon, I'd be at his house most days. And I had to sit there and just vomit my problems all over his table, you know, like I did most days. And he would give me some really wise counsel and I wouldn't do most of it. And I remember one day coming in and sitting down and we're sitting there and I started my little dance, whatever my dance was at that time. And he says, Harold, I want you to do me a favor. I want you to take your cup of coffee. I want you to go dump it out. And I want you to leave. I said, are you messing with me? He says, no, I'm not messing with you. I want you to take your cup of coffee, go dump it out in the sink, and I want you to leave. And I said, why? He says, because you're wasting my time. Obviously, your time's not very valuable, but my time's kind of valuable. And he said, you come over here with this same problem now for a while, and I've given you clear-cut directions of what I think you should do, and you haven't done any of it. So I'm not doing this dance with you anymore. I'm done. So see you later. And, of course, I left, and I was like, I had two battles going on me. Part of me wanted to cry, my feelings were hurt. The other part of me wanted to fight. I'm like kicking a can down the alley with a big old fat lip. You know, a few weeks later, I'm back knocking on the door and going, can we try this again? You know, and of course, it was a whole new journey for me. But it's a term that I use. I call it 96 of them, but it's the first paragraph on page 96, you know, and so if I get somebody that's on that thing, I just say, hey, I want you to do me a favor. I want you to read me that first paragraph on page 96 and then ask you how that applies to you and I's relationship. And sometimes that's a great way to move them in the right direction. Another time it's a point to say adios. You know, I really lean on the literature and the wise counsel that went ahead of us. Of course I would, but that's where I would do with it. That's kind of how it was done to me and made a difference in my life. But to not call somebody out on that is you're just helping them walk closer and closer to the cliff. You know, that's all you're doing. That's all I got. Thanks.
Thank you so much, guys. Next question, they are asking if you Do you qualify a man before you sponsor him?
I start out with, I never just say yes, at the home group or after you speak somewhere or something like that. I said, well, what I will agree to right now is to you know, have a cup of coffee or have lunch with you. And then, yeah, at that meeting, that's where the deal or the covenant, as Harold say, will come out. But yeah, I want to find out a little bit about him, see what's going on with him, see what he's tried, see what he knows about AA, about religion. I mean, kind of right out of the book stuff, you know, just find out whatever I can about him and, you know, to see that he really wants to do this and that he understands what he's asking. That's very important. I lay it right out. Like, look, you know, once, twice a week at the house, my expectation is you're on time. I'm going to be on time, you know, and go through this way. When somebody's late or something, well, look, that's not the deal we have. We said on time. This is not about, you know, my willingness. I left work early to be here, you know, so I start that right off the bat. I rarely like to change dates and all, because then you get into, oh, I thought it was Wednesday. I thought it was, no, we do Tuesdays, Thursday nights. Let's go, you know? So I want to set that all up in that first discussion before I agree to do that with someone. So that's it.
Steve, Harold, you guys want to say anything? You want me to move on?
Go ahead, Harold. No, Luke, I think he gave the answer I would have given. So Tommy's covered it for me.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, really, I mean, that's, and it's just a variable where they're at. I mean, the longer you stay sober, you'll have different people in different terms or different seasons of life or where they're at in their journey. If, you know, if I got somebody who's got 10 years, says, will you be willing to sponsor me? I mean, the rules of engagement are not going to change. But I'm my first conversation with them is I'm going to have them bring their eighth and ninth step with them. Because I've heard a lot more fourth and fifth steps than I ever have eighth and ninth steps. And so I already know there's work there to be done. And I want to know why they haven't done it yet, especially at that stage of their sobriety. And it's always entertaining, but really great opportunities to move people to a higher plane. So that's the only thing I would add, but Tommy nailed it.
Great. Awesome. Thanks guys so much. This one is really relatable for me. From somebody in the room, if somebody relapses, if a sponsee ends up relapsing and while they're actually in the middle of working their steps, would you have them start over at step one?
For me, that too is case by case and dependent on the individual and my understanding of what we've been doing together. And often to me, it feels like that will reveal that as the book says, we only think we've taken inventory. We only think we've humbled ourselves. So you might go back and re-examine and really, as I think Tommy said earlier about the first step, if the first step starts on a lie, that's a bad start. But if it also starts on a misunderstanding by the individual or a lack of surrender, that can be tough. So we may go back and look at that. But I think it's also, you can continue to spin out on those first three steps without ever moving forward. There have been other people I've chosen to just keep moving forward. And then, as it was said, circle back later if we need to.
Harold, Tommy, you got anything for that one?
No, I think Steve's right on. And the reality of it is, if they drank, they still got an alcoholic mind, as our book would say, and most likely they got secrets. You know, it's they got secrets, and it's the secrets that are killing them. That's what's causing, you know, the pain. And so, you know, and I've seen it happen a million times. I had a guy call me not many years ago and said that. You know, I just did a fourth and fifth step with this guy. I mean, he was honest, man. I mean, I'm telling you, he laid it out there. And then he's drunk. I mean, how can you get drunk after you do all that? That doesn't make any sense to me, because he didn't tell you everything. He goes, what, I mean, I'm telling you, he did a pretty thorough fifth step. I said, I'm telling you, he didn't tell you everything. And I tell you, it wasn't even hardly a week later, he was on the news for what he had done that he didn't tell him about. And so, that's the kind of stuff. So, I mean, you're as sick as your secret. So that's what I would add to it.
Oh, got you, Tom. Sorry.
Yes, I think what Steve said, that, you know, it's case by case, is definitely true. And also where you are in the steps, right? I mean, because it doesn't tell us until the 10th step that we've, you know, alcohol has been removed. You know, it doesn't tell us until then. But if it's after a fifth step, you really want to find out if he missed something. If it's right after one or during one, two, and three, what reservations might have happened. So maybe a review, but not, I am not from the school of let's go back and read every single line and re-highlight everything. Go get yourself a new book. And I've seen guys do that. I just don't think there's any value in that. This person needs to get through even quicker, I believe. You can't, this is not somebody that, they don't need more information. They need to touch God.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. All right. I have time for one more really quick one. We've got a couple more minutes. I have, the next question is, they know that they are alcoholic and stopped, but still wish to do weed. What do you tell them?
For me, I don't get into the debate with someone around that, but that is one of those things that I mentioned earlier that I'd say for my sensibilities and theirs would be so different that I'm not going to be the right person to sponsor you. And so we don't have to argue about it, but that won't work for me. And I'll just move forward from that.
Yeah, and I would just concur that. I mean, I would define sobriety as being free from alcohol and all mood-altering substances, period. And if we can't agree to that, that would be part of the original covenant. And if we can't agree to that, then we're not going to be able to do this journey together. I'd say
my seniors covered it very well.
Okay, great. Well, let me see here. Might have time for one more. No, actually, okay. So the last question that I have in the chat is, do you sponsor men and women or just strictly men?
Well, I think Pete already commented on that, but I mean, he might want to chime in again. I only sponsor guys. There's been a few times in sobriety but we're in an intermediate situation where I, you know, just kind of bridged a gap for somebody. But it was very intermediate. It was very transparent with the sponsors about that. I got their 2 cents on it before I agreed to it. I mean, to give one example, I had a young lady, when I say younger, she's younger than me, but she had 30 plus years of sobriety. I've known her since day one. And she went off the, you know, she didn't drink, but she went off the reservation for the most part. And she was suggested she called me and we worked through a few things, you know, for a quick season, maybe 3 or 4 months to help her get back in on the beam. But once she was on the beam, it was, you know, she was on her wheel. But that's just me. But I try to just stick with the guys, you know. It's just healthy for a guy like me to do that.
Yeah, this has been a one-off for me, and the woman that I sponsor was over 20 years sober when I started sponsoring. I'd known her all that time. My wife knows her. I talked to both my sponsor and my wife, and many times she has also talked to my wife, who's also 31 years sober. And so it's not something that I think would work for me on this feels kind of singular, and it may happen again, but it's certainly not something that I am doing on a regular basis.
Yeah, the women that I had sponsored, and I did it for about 5 or 6 years, were recommendations from my wife. She asked me to help different women out, but it really just didn't work for me, and I felt it wasn't working for them. Two of the women said it worked fine. Two of the women were holding things back, but it didn't feel right. I just treated them different. I spoke to them differently than I did the guys, and it made me a little bit uncomfortable. So it's not something I'll do moving forward.
Amber, let me say what Tommy just ended with, and it'll be, I think, put a period on what we've talked about when you said it wasn't working for him. And Tom, who we've all mentioned at one time years ago, Tom told me, he said, Steve, if sponsorship's not working for one of you, it's not working for either of you. And that's something that I've taken to heart over the years, too. So thanks again.
Wow. Thank you guys so, so much for this tonight. This was amazing. I have asked Brooke to go ahead and read the 10th step promises for me.
Hi, I'm Brooke. I'm an alcoholic. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. for by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition.